Welcome to Strange Dominions. I am your host, Octavian Graves. Tonight, my co-host Luke Bell and I interview W.T. Watson, author of Mysteries in the Mist. We discuss Bigfoot, Dogman, Djinn, spirits, the fog, and magical techniques to deal with all of those phenomena. If you've seen something strange or unusual, such as a cryptid, UFO, spirit, anything in between, send me an email at strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. Our Patreon is up, and there are two episodes on there already. If you would like to support the show and get exclusive content, you can become a patron for $4 a month, and that includes extra episodes, merchandise, and the opportunity to be on the show. With that, let's get into the episode. That was a sample from John Carpenter's 1980 film, The Fog. And that is most appropriate because I have with me W.T. Watson talking about Mysteries in the Fog. How you doing, Travis?
Great. I'm doing good. So just to clarify, everybody, I'm W.T. Watson. That's the author name, but I go by Travis when I do these interviews. So here yes. I am.
And I have with me Luke Bell.
Hello there. How are we?
Very good. And like I said, we're talking about Mysteries in the Fog, which is, Travis, I have to say, this is a really, really well done book. I love, it's a very entertaining book, and it's so well researched. It was really, really a joy to read.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. When I do one of these books, and this is my second nonfiction, I did a book on Phantom Black Dogs as well. When I do one of these books, I go looking for just any kind of source that's out there that maybe people hadn't heard of before. I know that when I did the Phantom Black Dog book, I was talking to somebody who was a real, very interested in the lore of black dogs. And one of the things he told me was, there were some stories in there I hadn't heard before. And that makes my little researcher heart happy. Because that's my goal is when I do one of these books, I want to introduce the reader to the idea and give them a lot of different stories, witness accounts, tales from legend and that sort of thing. And provide them with sources so that if they're curious about one aspect or the other of whatever it is I'm talking about, they can go and they can say, oh, that's in the bibliography. There's this, 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 and this. And I can look this book up and I can go and I can find out more about that. And of course, those books are going to have bibliographies that help you go down the rabbit hole. And that's what I do when I write is I go down a rabbit hole. I had no idea how deep the rabbit hole on this one was going to be.
Yeah, and I absolutely can tell. It's interesting because fog and mist are such a essential aspect to, horror movies and just kind of like the dark gothic ambience. And I'm curious about what was the thing that made you realize that it wasn't just a trope, but an actual phenomena.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think that part of the reason that fog and mist and clouds and those kinds of things are so common in the horror genre, the creepy thing is, you have that idea of visual obscuration and something out there that could be threatening to you. I got involved with this research as a result of several different things. When I was doing the research for the Phantom Black Dog book, Phantom Black Dogs, Walkers of the Liminal Way, I came across a number of stories that had fog involved in them. And of course, because Phantom Black Dogs are, they're most well known in Great Britain, of course, that made a lot of sense. But probably the best example, or the one that always sticks in my mind, a fellow who was one of the first editors for the Oxford English Dictionary, had taken his family on a on an outing, on a vacation, a holiday, as they call it, and into the mountains of the UK. They were on a hike. They got socked in by fog. And anybody who's done search and rescue will tell you, if that happens, especially on a mountainside, the best thing to do is to stop, be still, wait for the fog to pass so you can see where you're going. I guess this fellow didn't get the letter. He kept going forward, trying to follow a path in this mountainous area. And this large black dog materializes out of the fog and blocks his path. He tries to go around this dog several times. The dog just absolutely refuses to move. Now, this is not the classic phantom black dog with the glowing red eyes and stuff. It was just simply a big black dog. He had no idea he was having a paranormal experience until he, until the fog started to dissipate, and with it, the dog disappeared as well. And the interesting part of the story is that had he continued to go forward along the path that he was going forward on, he would have gone right off of a cliff. So this is a great story about the phantom black dog and its guardian aspect, which is something that people don't hear about a lot. We hear a lot about the phantom black dog as a harbinger of death or doom or whatever. This was one of the guardian stories. There are a bunch of those as well. The second thing that got me going down this rabbit hole was not an experience that happened to me, but an experience that happened to a friend of mine when I was back in my 20s, so many, many moons ago. this fellow was a gamer, and he also was involved in some kind of sketchy occult stuff, things that he was interested in. You know, he was really interested in things like the Necronomicon. He liked, you know, he was into the whole dark gothy thing before it was really a thing. This was a guy who, you know, was known to wear black nail polish and that kind of stuff back before it was really like you know, before goths were goths really. Went to bed one night, had to get up and go to work the next day. Went to bed one night, got up in the night, as you do, wandered into his hallway and looked in a mirror that was hanging in the hallway to see the surface of the mirror fill with clouds and then feel inexorably drawn into the mirror. Fortunately for him, his girlfriend was staying the night, and I guess something disturbed her. She got up and she found him with his face literally plastered against the mirror, and he was not cognizant of what he was doing. She pulled him away from the mirror. If she let him go, he would try to go back. She finally, after probably two or three tries, broke him loose from this thing, got him to go back to bed, and then, you know, tucked him back in and kept him there. He told her the next day that he felt that he was being, that his what we might call astral body, was being drawn into this mirror. And that, you know, if she hadn't come along and rescued him, who knows what she would have found in the morning. That incident, you know, might or might not have been the result of, you know, some chemical usage that he indulged in on occasion. But what I'll say is that whether or not he was having a bad trip or he actually had a, you know, a psychic experience of some kind, it definitely changed his life. He, you know, got rid of a bunch of the kind of sketchy stuff that he had, and, you know, just kind of walked away from the whole magic thing altogether, which, you know, I can't argue with, given that experience.
It's a shame, but it does happen.
it does happen, and it usually comes about because you're fooling with things that you maybe shouldn't ought to be fooling with without the proper training and discipline, which he did not have. So the third thing that got me going on this, again, was research. I had been thinking about the fog stories and Phantom Black Dogs, and I was reading in Linda Godfrey's wonderful collection of works, and came across a couple of stories which are in the introduction, I think, where trail cameras had caught strange fog, strange mists, in relationship to the disappearance of roadkill that had been placed out for some kind of an unknown creature on a ranch or farm. All these things combined to make me think, and we talked, I mentioned that I'd also had a chat with Tim Renner on Strange Familiars, and we had talked about these signs that Tim looks for in looking for a paranormal incursion. Things like the Oz effect, the silence that comes over people, that sense of time dislocation. Tim adds things like anomalous lights, light phenomena, and those sorts of things. I got to wondering if maybe these fogs, these paranormal fogs weren't, or these fogs weren't a sign as well of a paranormal incursion. And that's what got me started down this rabbit hole. As you say, there's tons of reference material in the book to show you kind of where I went. And it does cover almost every aspect of the paranormal you can think of.
Yeah, you don't shy away from any topic. I mean, everything is up for game here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I'm going to present work to people, then I want to try and make the work as broad-based as possible. So that, if you have an interest in Sasquatch, there's something in this book for you. If you have an interest in ghosts, there's something in this book for you. If you have an interest in UFOs, there's something in this book for you. If you have an interest in mysterious disappearances, there's something in this book for you. So I really try to make it so that people who are interested in the paranormal, can read my books and think, and look at other aspects of the paranormal that they hadn't even thought about, as well as the things that really interest them. So that's kind of what I try to do.
Well, that's kind of where we're coming from too, because this whole show is trying to find the connections between the esoteric and the paranormal. And to start us off, I think one of the really cool things is, you have, I know you refer to them as man wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this is a really, really interesting topic, because the dog-headed entity shows up in so many different forms and in so many different mythologies and hierarchies. I mean, Anubis, many of the South American deities have dog-headed associations, and also there's at least one spirit of the grimoires that is a dog-headed entity, and he unlocks gates. That is what he is, the unlocker of things. And I think that's a really, really interesting coalesce of phenomena.
Absolutely. I hate to keep referring back to a previous book, but I do a whole section about dogs and their relationship to death in the Phantom Black Dog book. And, of course, Anubis is the probably the first black dog that you find wandering the pages of mythology, but he's not the only one. You have Cerberus and there's a Norse that's slipping my mind right
Fenrir?
Now. Not Fenrir, the protector of hell.
Oh, Garm.
Garm, yes. All of whom are mentioned as being dusky or black. When you start to talk about dogs and dog-headed entities, you also have that whole myth about, I think it was Saint Christopher, who was supposed to be a kind of Sfali, who was, came from a whole race of dog-headed people, apparently. It's like, okay. And these guys lived where? how did we find out about that? You know, I mean, you know, these, it's, and as you say, when you go through magical war, then you come on, you know, groups of spirits that perhaps are, take this particular form. As you said, there's a goetic spirit, that takes a form like that, whose name slips my mind right now, but,
Luke, do you know which one we're talking about?
A goetic spirit that takes what form, sorry?
There's a spirit either in the Goetia or in another grimoire that, takes the form of like a dog-headed entity or a wolf-headed, you know, like a wolf man, basically.
You're referring to Marcosius, maybe?
I believe so.
I think that may be it, yeah. But yes, so, I mean, and if you have done any other world walking, so to speak, then you're liable to have run into something along this line, in conjunction to, say, sacred sites, and that sort of thing. You know, I have, you know, Linda Godfrey has a theory that the man wolves, you know, at least some of the man wolves were actually guardians of what they call burial mounds in the Midwest. We don't really know what they are. The large serpent mounds and things like that. In my mind, you know, and this is something I try to bring forward in my books, you know, anything is possible, really. So these beings may be coming from another place and manifesting themselves here on our plane, or they could be adapted timber wolves. Who knows? This is one of the fun things about exploring these topics, is they are mysteries. We don't really know what's going on.
You know, Hecate, who is very popular right now, mm-hmm. one of her forms is to be a black dog, or many people see black dogs when they are working with her.
Right.
And it's also interesting because she is an entity or a deity of witchcraft and the underworld. And so there's mm-hmm. another connection there. But man-wolves are really interesting because I believe it's in your book about the fog showing up and then a dogman, man-wolf showing up immediately after, almost like following mm-hmm. The fog. And that would be, if this is just a living flesh and blood creature, for it to know where fog is going to manifest, that takes, you know, there's a lot there that I don't really see happening with just a regular flesh and blood animal.
Yeah. Just to back up to Hecate for a minute. If you follow Jason Miller at all, or have read his Protection and Reversal Magic, there's a wonderful banishing, Hecate, banishing spell in that book that, actually involves dog-headed entity, taking one of the seats in one of the directions to help protect and banish, around the individual. And Hecate is world walker. She has both underworld and very strong overworld. She goes where she wants, characteristics. So, and yeah, the whole black dog thing around Hecate is definitely a thing. I've seen that in vision myself. So, I don't spend a lot of time talking about it in the book, but it's certainly something that has motivated me motivated me in writing that particular book. As far as the man wolves, and some people like to call them dog men. I feel that way.
That's the term that I grew up with, but I understand why a lot of people feel it's silly. I know that Tim Renner also feels it's a silly term.
Well, it's not even so much that it's silly. I'm very animistic in my belief processes, and I believe in respecting spirits. And so to me, it's like, if I'm going to talk about Sasquatch, I'll talk about Sasquatch, because I kind of find the term Bigfoot a little insulting. You know, I mean, if I were one of these creatures and people were walking around talking about my feet all the time, I wouldn't be too happy about it. So I always try to err on the side of caution when it comes to, you know, having respect for whatever it is we're talking about. Whether, you know, I mean, as I said, with the man wolves, you know, there's the theory that it could be an adapted wolf. I don't know. But if it is the spirit that's coming over to our side to our dimension, then, you know, I want to try to be sure that I'm respectful of that. And I think man wolf is a whole lot more respectful title than a dog man. That seems a little derogatory to me. Well, hello.
Sorry, the tail. He can't stop.
Yes. Is that Freya?
No, this is Grim.
No, that's your other guy. Yeah, okay. Hi, Grim.
When you were doing research for the book and you were looking at the man-wolf stories, did you find that the fog in the man-wolf stories were, you know, a one and done? Or how, like, were you finding more fog in dogman stories than not?
It seemed to me that a number of the stories that I looked at had to do with fog. The classic one being the one of the original Beast of Bray Road witnesses actually was driving down Bray Road, had a bump in the road, thought that they had hit a farmer's dog and stopped to see, you know, to see if there was anything they could do. Got out of the vehicle, and it was, you know, the stereotypical dark and foggy night. This man wolf materializes out of the fog and is charging her. And, fortunately she jumps back in her car and closes the door and drives off. The thing got close enough to actually get claws into the side of her car. And she showed Linda Godfrey the scratch marks on the vehicle. Of course, that doesn't prove anything, but it does lend some, you know, credibility to the fact that she saw something. My feeling, though, was that, you know, I was conflicted about the man wolf stories, because on the one hand, you know, it's entirely possible that this thing, whatever it is some kind of an ambush predator, and it would take advantage of fog or cornfields, which are another classic thing in man wolf stories, to mask its presence until it wanted you to see it. And there's a very clear feeling in a lot of these stories that these things want to be seen. You know, they're unlike the Sasquatch, which is the hide and seek champion of the world. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, it does seem like they want to be seen. And it's interesting because there's been a lot of reports that I've read and listened to where these things get right up in people's faces and then mm-hmm. walk away. It's almost, yeah, you know, a lot of people say that they seem to just want to scare you and then walk away. And that's such unusual behavior for any kind of predator.
Yeah. So the thing is, you know, if you study wolves in the wild, it's not so unusual when you consider that wolves are very territorial creatures. They have a pack territory, and they will engage in behavior like bluff charges and, you know, showing fangs and, you know, really scaring the crud out of any other wolf that comes into their territory. Those behaviors seldom result in fights unless the other wolf refuses to back down. And even then, they aren't typically fatal. It'll be a situation where the other creatures run out of the area. So my feeling about this behavior, this aggressive behavior, is that these things, whatever they are extremely territorial. And they don't want you in their neighborhood. So, you know, if you're out wandering around, whatever, and you come across one of these things, it's going to try to get you out of its territory. And we see this kind of behavior with phantom black dogs too, where, you know, the phantom black dogs on Meridine Island in Wisconsin, I think, are well known for actually giving chase to people until they hit a certain segment of the road that leads out of that area, and then they're gone. So, it's not, I don't think it's that unusual. The thing that really arises in my mind, though, in the fog cases, because there are a couple where this creature comes out of the fog and shows itself to a person, chases a person, or whatever. Is the creature using the fog as a visual cover, or is the creature actually using the fog to manifest itself? Much like we see, spirits being manifested into visibility using incense in some ceremonial rites. And, I can't answer that question. So.
Well, yeah, and that's a very interesting point, because if it's just, like I said, it's one thing if it was just somehow knowing where the fog was going to manifest and then, following it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's weird enough. But then you add in the idea that it actually has some kind of control over the fog and can use it at its own will. And I think
is it actually producing
idea.
The fog?
Yeah, exactly. I'm curious to know if, when you were looking through these stories, if you noticed if the presence of fog changed the attitude or behavior of the dogman, as opposed to stories of man wolves where there wasn't any fog present.
Not that I noticed. What I found was that a lot of times when these creatures were appearing out of fog, they were engaging in much the same behaviors that you see in some of the other stories where it's a clear day or clear night and the creature is just trying to get people out of its territory. So the behavior seems to be the same. Of course, the episodes where the thing appears out of the fog tend to be even more horrifying to people than the ones where it happens on clear. At least you see this thing coming. If it's a clear day, it's one thing when it's 100 yards away and you can say, okay, I think maybe I should vacate the premises, and another when it appears out of the fog and it's 20 yards away or 10 yards away. And from all reports, these things move very quickly. I think, honestly, if one of these creatures really wanted to get somebody, it could. Again, we see that sort of bluff charge behavior where they will, run up and they're growling and doing all this stuff, but they never quite catch you.
They're just, you're always out of reach.
Yeah. You're just always kind of got this thing breathing down your neck until you get up a tree or, whatever it is. And then it will walk around and growl at the base of the tree and, be all mean and bad. And then, eventually it goes away.
Did you notice in any of these stories? Now, I know this isn't necessarily a fog question, but with the dogman reports, was there any increase in dogman reports with full moon in the scenario, or does that not even seem to matter as far as when people see them?
Yeah. So the fact is that in the vast majority of the reports that I looked at, and I have read all of Linda Godfrey's books and so forth, so I am fairly conversant with the lore of these creatures, with the modern day witness reports. The vast majority of them don't mention the moon phase. I have seen a couple, I have seen a couple where the moon, somebody mentioned that the moon was full because, it was important to their story and that they could see and there was light. But I have not, I'd be interested in seeing whether there's any extrapolation between the full moon and the appearance of these creatures. But I don't think anybody has done that work.
Well, one thing that I would really like to see in paranormal research is more people who do research these things and investigate it start noting the atmospheric changes and the, the day and hour that they mm-hmm. may experience something, or that they're going out looking for something, and what phase the moon is in, because I feel like that has a bigger factor than people are realizing. And obviously I'm coming from a magical perspective here, because I do believe that there is a strong connection to the two, and that includes magical techniques to investigate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's the planetary hour? You know, what's the phase of the moon? All of those things could have a bearing on the presence or absence of these creatures, and we're talking about creatures over a wide scale of paranormal, from the Sasquatch to the man wolf to some of the weird lake monster things that I'm investigating right now, researching right now. So, I would be super interested in seeing investigators use that kind of information, in addition to, is it raining? Is it foggy? Is it, is it a clear day? Is the wind blowing? All of the other, physical things that you might take into account as a field investigator. Did you find tracks? Yeah, this is one of the things that makes me crazy in reading a lot of witness reports is, and I understand why. If you've had a man-wolf encounter, you might not really want to go back to that place for a while, but I would love to see some more intrepid folks out there that are, younger than I am and willing to go out in the field. I'd love to see some folks go out and look at these sites. And it's like, because, you get all these UFO investigators that go out and find all these physical signs, right? They find these, indentations in the ground and all that sort of stuff, right?
Bigfoot researchers too.
Yeah, and Bigfoot people too. Yeah, I'd love to see that with the man wolf, for instance. We do occasionally see reports of tracks and of large canid tracks. One of those stories that I was referring to earlier in the interview, where there was a mysterious fog that came along, and then this roadkill would disappear, and they would find these huge canid tracks around there that appeared to be bipedal, and they had some man-wolf sightings in the area and that sort of thing. I'd love to have more information about those things.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we move on, Luke, do you have any comments or questions about this topic?
Yeah, I mean, I find this all to be really, really fascinating. I think that the thing that keeps springing to my mind, and whether or not there's any veracity to it, is obviously up for debate, but there's a long history in the grimoire tradition, in folklore and in ceremonial magic, of spirits being wards or protectors of places. And the idea that these spirits don't, or the, I'm already referring to them as spirits, these entities don't seem to follow through in causing physical harm to the people that they're charging at or that they're chasing. I find quite interesting. It almost seems to me, as a layperson, when it comes to this particular topic, like they're protecting something, like there's something there that they don't want people going near. And I would be fascinated to know what that is.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really, really important point, because I think that, these things almost act as like the tough guy genus loci, if we can use that phrase. Mm-hmm.
So, I mentioned earlier that Linda Godfrey has noted an extrapolation between the presence of these creatures, whatever they are, whether they're spirits or whatever, and First Nations, what they call burial mounds, which may or may not be burial mounds. But I certainly think that at least some of the cases that we see are examples of spirit guardians, beings that have been placed there to keep people from interfering with whatever it is. One of Godfrey's very early stories, if I recall, was in the 1930s. Came across one of these, a night watchman actually came across one of these creatures digging in the side of one of these mounds. And when he approached it, because he didn't realize what it was at first, shined a flashlight on it, it looked at him and said something like Gadara, which if I remember correctly from the book, is might have been a reference to demoniac possession in the New Testament. So the very like, okay, why would it be digging in the side of one of these mounds? And, you know, this is obviously a spirit that's come, if it was a spirit that had come to complete physical manifestation, because it left traces behind. I think there's a really strong possibility, just from my own meditative experiences, that these beings are, or at least some of these beings are, guardians of places, and or guardians of people, as in the case of Hecate, actually a deity, somebody who works for a deity. I think any of those things are entirely possible. And of course, they get ignored completely in mainstream paranormal research.
Luke, I have a question. In a lot of the conversations that we've had about spirits and their abilities, we've talked about, being able to gain a familiar from a spirit to do a very specific task. And I'm curious if you've ever come across any spirits that specialize in protection of individuals or protection of a group of people, or if that factors into any aspects of spirit work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is an incredibly long tradition of that. You know, I mean, I think that aside from finding riches and treasure, protection from harm is one of the main things that any magician has ever conjured spirits for, be that protection from illness or protection in wartime. I think there's a lot of historical precedent to that. So it's, you know, that is a very well-trodden path in magic, conjuring spirits for protection, not just of yourself, but to guard treasure that you've buried somewhere that you want to keep away from thieves or grave robbers, or protection over particular people. There's a very, very long, long, long history of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like, and like you, Travis, I'm very, kind of thinking, so I think at least some of these cases definitely have hallmarks of a spirit being tasked with protecting a place or even a group of people, like the First Nations people. It could be possible that there's a whole group of spirits that are tasked with just protecting their lands and their way of life.
Yeah, I mean, we know that, that the people of the First Nations have powerful spirits that work with them. There's what people call shaman, medicine people, however you want to term that, the magical practitioners in that particular tradition, basically. All you have to do is read some of the biographies of some of the plains, in Lakota, they call them Wakasawakan, the holy people, who were able to do these incredible things. Because of the spirits that they worked with. I see no reason why if you were setting up a burial mound, for instance, or some other sacred space or sacred area for your tribe or clan or whatever you want to call it, you wouldn't have a situation where your shaman, medicine people, however you want to term that, wouldn't call forth somebody to take care of that area and keep it sacred and safe.
Absolutely. We're going to move on to, I'm a huge Sasquatch fan. It's one of my favorite areas in the paranormal. And I do put that in the paranormal. But before we get into that, I thought we could talk a little bit about vampires, because this is not really a topic that is mentioned in any kind of serious way in the paranormal. It's kind of always been designated as a purely fictional area in the paranormal. But you kind of present the idea that there are these kind of vampiric entities that people encounter and are heavily associated with fog.
Yeah, so it's actually, I spend a good bit of time in the book talking about that relationship between this idea from Dracula and so forth that vampires disappear into fog and so forth. And then I look at the lore and say, maybe maybe not. But before I get started on that, you know, we have to differentiate when we talk about vampires, what we're talking about. There is a subculture in the United States of people who, for whatever reason, feel that they are lacking in vital energy. They have the disability, basically, and who, you know, work in or who work with donors to accumulate more personal energy, and who have bought in strongly to the whole vampire ethos, you know, a la Dracula and all that sort of thing, you know, the dark clothes and all that sort of thing, you know, the wearing of fangs, so on and so forth. I am no expert in that subculture, but, you know, I think it needs to be mentioned that there are people out there who identify as vampires, and that's not what we're talking about. There are also a number of beings on the astral that I would basically qualify as parasitics or parasites. They're low-level entities that basically, you know, scoot around and live on negative emotions. I had a teacher early on who said that, you know, if you are clairvoyant enough, you know, you go into one of these dive bars where, you know, people are not having really a good time, you can find these things floating around the ceilings, and they're just sucking up the bad vibes, right? So these beings could be referred to as vampiric in the sense that they are taking people's energy, you know, they're taking people's life force in the form of those negative emotions and so forth, and basically feasting on them, living off them, somewhat analogous to the hungry ghosts in Buddhism. When we talk about vampires, though, we're talking about a very specific type of revenant, for want of a better term. If you've read John Michael Greer's Monsters, An Investigator's Guide to Magical Beings, he does a whole chapter on vampires and talks about the second death and how there are certain debased methods for avoiding the second death. And those people who have shed their physical bodies but are able to live on this plane by basically sucking up the life force of the people around them. And using that to keep their etheric body intact. Whether you buy that or not, there's there's a whole group of lore or a section of lore around these creatures. And I got thinking in reading the Dracula mythology and, you know, this idea of the vampire disappearing into fog, I got to thinking, well, does that really happen in the lore, or is that just something that Bram Stoker made up? And the answer is maybe. In the lore, one of the things about vampires, these etheric revenants that are feeding on people, and they very seldom in the lore are actually like the guy walking around, going to grab you and suck your blood, right? There is an understanding in Eastern European lore that these creatures are not physical, so to speak, although they may have sort of a jelly-like structure to them when you encounter them, because they have a surfeit of etheric energy around them. But so there is a belief amongst the people in Eastern Europe, particularly Romania. The writer's name was Mergoxi, I believe. I don't know how you pronounce that name, but these people believe that you really, if you thought you were coming to the attention of a vampire, needed to ward your house and needed to be sure that your house was completely warded, including the keyholes. So the implication was that this being could in some way, shape, or form, perhaps as a fog or mist, make its way, or a gas, make its way through your keyhole into your home. You know, and so you had to, or down your chimney. So you had to be sure that all of those places were warded with the, you know, the standard. And that's where the garlic thing comes in. Garlic was seen as one of those things that repelled these spirits. So do vampires dissolve into mist and move around? Maybe. The lore seems to support the idea that these beings are able to pass through small openings that, you know, a physical body couldn't pass through. So do they do it in the form of fog or mist? We can't really be sure. The lore's not clear on that. We just know that they can move from outside the door to inside the door through a keyhole if they needed to. You know, the idea of the vampire dissolving into mist is maybe, if it's not directly from the lore, it may be implied from the lore.
That's really fascinating. Luke, do you have any comments on this?
I actually do, yeah. I think that, interestingly enough, what Travis mentioned, specifically bringing up garlic. Now, the ancient Egyptian temple priests, who essentially were professional practitioners of magic, freelancing as magicians on the times that they weren't in the temples, were forbidden from eating garlic or fish or anything that is that was strong smelling prior to re-entering the temple if they had a period of absence from there. And this is, again, something that keeps cropping up as a correlation between these areas of paranormal research and the grimoire and occult tradition, is that pleasant smells like incense are appeasing to spiritual creatures, and things that are maybe more repugnant, things like, you know, sulfur, asafoetida, garlic, these sorts of things are things that will drive them away. So it's interesting that even in the vampire mythology of Eastern Europe, that we see that same intersection there.
Yeah, that is a really fascinating correlation.
I found that it was a very interesting little short dive into a rabbit hole, because the vampire that we all visualize when you hear that word, is not the vampire that Eastern Europeans were afraid of. Very seldom was there talk of, you know, like a physical body rising from a grave and going, you know, around and biting people or whatever. The understanding was that this was a being of, this is a spiritual being of some type that was, for whatever reason, living off of the life energy of people, and it would kill its victims. If allowed to continue long enough, it would actually, you know, cause their demise. So it was a very real fear. Greer points out that modern Western methods of body disposal pretty much make it unlikely that one of these creatures would manifest in a place like the United States or Canada. That it would be much more likely that they would manifest in more primitive areas where bodies were just buried whole in the ground without being interfered with. Because his assertion was that the destruction of the body, or the filling of the body with chemicals and so forth, would actually disrupt this magician's basically ability to escape the second death. So it was a fascinating, fascinating look at Eastern European lore, though.
Yeah, it really is. Now that kind of brings us to Jin. And Luke, I want you to take the charge on this, because I know that you're somewhat familiar with this topic.
Of the Jin? I mean, I'm absolutely no expert on Arabian or Arabic magic at all. But from what I do know of it, jinn seem to follow a lot of the same behavioral patterns that we see with spirits of the Goetia, chthonic spirits, as some might refer to them, that they are morally ambiguous, temperamental in their behavior, fiery, not always honest. I'm no expert on Arabian magic specifically or Arabian mythology, but magicians for a very long time have been drawing the correlation between these class of spirits that appear in the Muslim tradition and the Western ceremonial tradition, and some of those named spirits have even found their way into grimoires like the Heptameron. You see the names of the aerial kings, which some magicians have suggested were actually jinn spirits from Arabian pantheons. But from what I know of people who have engaged with these particular beings, is that they are not particularly loving of people. And they can be, to say that they're temperamental would perhaps be the understatement of the millennia.
And this is for either of you. The term beings of smokeless fire, where does that come from? What does that mean exactly?
It's actually a phrase from the Quran. There's a whole surah, the whole chapter in the Quran about the jinn, they are said to have been created from smokeless fire, and created prior to the creation of humankind, and got themselves into some trouble after humans were created, when they refused to basically bow down to Adam and acknowledge him as a superior being. They were kind of like, what? He's made out of mud. I'm a creature of smokeless fire. Why should I bow down to this thing? A lot of the lore that surrounds the jinn too reminds me very much, and I sort of see the jinn as Middle Eastern cousins to the fairy race in Celtic lore, because there's a lot of correlation there. Now, when you talk about spirits, it's very difficult. I know that the ceremonialists and the grimoiric tradition people, we're always trying to label spirits and put them into little, this is what this spirit does. In my experience of spirits, and I don't claim that my experience is the be all and end all of anything, but spirits evolve like people do, and they may evolve into different behaviors and different abilities. When we talk about the jinn and fog, the classic story that I relate in the book is one by Rosemary Allen Diley, who is a very famous paranormal researcher who passed some years ago. Must have been a fairly intrepid woman. Actually went to Jordan, and she had found out that there was this cave where the jinn were supposed to live. So she talked a couple of locals into taking her out there, and got there. They found an entrance to the cave. It was basically a straight drop down into a cavern. So she actually harnessed up and started to rappel into this cavern. She got some distance into the cavern, and her story was that she saw a green mist, a green fog, which is also something we see in the fairy lore it's this green mist or fog that is known to be produced by fairy. She saw this green mist, and as she got closer to the bottom of the cavern, she felt that she was hearing a voice, but she wasn't sure whether she was hearing it audibly or whether she was hearing it in her mind telling her that she needed to get the heck out of there, to leave, to go away, basically. She started to go back up the rope, and fortunately she made it to the top before her two guides had taken off on her, because they told her that what they saw was a green mist forming into a djinn being and telling her to basically get the hell out. This was their territory. So, you know, you had a difference in perception there, but both parties, you know, were convinced that something peculiar had happened and that it took the form of a green mist, which I thought was fascinating.
It's quite interesting how accepted the djinn, the existence of the djinn is in Arabic culture. Even those who would consider themselves to be, you know, not particularly superstitious or spiritual or religious in any way, it's just like, well, yeah, the djinn exists and you don't go bothering them, you know. And
yeah,
I've even personally spoken to veterans from, you know, the Gulf War who have been out in the desert and seen and heard things that they still to this day can't explain. They seem to be extremely corporeal and they're not shy about making their presence known if they're upset with you by the looks of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The belief in the djinn is actually a tenet of their faith. It's in their, like I said, it's in their Quran. So, if you're a Muslim, even if you're not a very good Muslim, then you probably believe the djinn exists. And
there's another correlation to that in fairy lore, because within the British Isles and places like Iceland, even people who are not superstitious at all, they take great heed of areas that fairies may be in existence.
Yeah, and also, you know, with the djinn, one of their, and this is a little side story, but one of their beliefs, the beliefs about these creatures is that their two favorite forms when they manifest here in here on the earth plane are a snake or a black dog, which. And there have been reports from soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan and stuff of mysterious black dogs that have appeared in their combat zones. I had a Muslim neighbor when I was in Atlanta, and I also happened to have a black dog. So it was a black border collie mix, and I would go to take this dog out, and these people would be coming out their door, and they would run back in their apartment and slam their door and lock it. They wanted nothing to do with my dog. That's how strong their belief in these creatures are. It's like, you know, you've got a djinn in your house. Why are you keeping this thing in your home? It is a very powerful belief amongst Middle Eastern, North African cultures. Fascinating book about that is Legend of the Fire Spirits by Robert Lebling, if people are interested in knowing more about the djinn and the actual lore of the djinn and not what somebody says about them. and it's in English, so you can actually read it.
Wonderful. I'll have to pick that up because the djinn are very, very interesting to me.
Yeah. It's a great book, and it covers a wide area from, you know, Arabia, like I said, across North Africa and all throughout the Middle East. It's a very good book.
Now let's talk about Sasquatch and fairies, kind of combine the two.
Oh,
because
boy.
That they're more synonymous with each other than I think people give them credit for. And I know that you took a couple pages out of the Josh Cutchin world. And so I'm curious about the research you did for that and what you were finding as far as both the connection between Bigfoot and mist or Sasquatch and mist and the Sasquatch fairy connection and their connection to the mist, you know, fog.
You could go on and on and on about that. There is that subset of researchers into the Sasquatch phenomena who are determined that, you know, they're after a relict hominid or an unknown species of bipedal ape. And you're not ever going to persuade these people that that's not the case. And you know what? I'm okay with that. I am perfectly willing to believe that there is a relict hominid or a bipedal unknown species of ape running around in places like British Columbia or the Pacific Northwest, dense forest lands where, you know, it's really possible for something like that to exist. There's a a whole species of bison that was lost for several decades, they thought was extinct, that popped back up in the 1950s here in Canada. If you can lose the largest land animal in North America, the woodland bison, if you can lose those guys for 40 years, then hey, it's possible there's a big ape running around out there somewhere. I'm okay with that. But this is where you come into the both and thinking. You know, I also think that there's a very strong spiritual aspect, you know, as in a spirit aspect of the Sasquatch lore. You know, and all you have to do is read Tim Renner and Joshua Cutchins, Where the Footprints End, and that'll, you know.
Amazing seminal book, honestly. I was just rereading it last night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's enough stories in there, just in those two books, to keep you, you know, from, you know, just totally buying into the whole ape theory. Because there's something distinctly weird about some, again, I say some, not all, some of these sightings, experiences, encounters. In relation to the fog, you know, I, in the book, make the jump over the pond to the UK, where you have the Grey Man of Machdui, who manifests.
I'm really glad that you put that in the story, because that's a really, really fascinating story that rarely gets connected to the Sasquatch phenomena, but I think it should.
But it's describing the exact same kind of behavior as what a lot of the Sasquatch researchers take as presence of a Sasquatch without actually seeing one. It's like, oh, well, it throws rocks. Okay, well, the Gray Man throws rocks. You know, it makes sounds in the bush. Well, you know, this thing is supposed to tromp around on the mountains, scare the crap out of people. You know, it's you know, people have seen something that looked like a large bipedal creature on the mountain and actually have shot at it with zero effect, of course. So, you know, the kinds of things that Sasquatch researchers, you know, the sounds, the noises, the, you know, the so forth, the kinds of things that Sasquatch researchers in the field regularly take as the presence of a Sasquatch apply directly to the Gray Man. But, you know, according to Sasquatch researchers who are into the whole ape theory, there couldn't possibly be a Sasquatch in the UK, because there's just not enough forest space or whatever for them to exist. Okay. Explain to me then how there are Sasquatches in Kansas, you know, which seems to be an accepted thing. If you've ever driven through Kansas, there's no cover. You know, but still, you know, you get these reports every once in a while from places like Kansas, where it's like, where are they living? Underground?
Kind of brings up the Chthonic reference there.
Yeah, well, you know, had to go there, right? So, but anyway, the Gray Man is also associated with fog, because almost all of these stories happen, you know, on the stereotypical dark and stormy day with, you know, major fog up on the mountainside. And these people will encounter this thing, whatever it is, they have this feeling they're being followed. You know, again, you get the Oz effect thing, something's going on, you know, have this feeling they're being followed, hear footsteps, you know, maybe hear rocks moving around, that kind of thing. You know, which ties right into poltergeist phenomena too, as other people have mentioned. But they'll hear this thing, and then you get a really interesting phenomena happens. Almost invariably, in the witness encounter, at some point, the witness freaks out. I mean, they experience panic, okay, in the very real sense of the word. So you wonder, you know, you got to tie that back to the whole nature spirit thing.
Luke, you can probably back me up on this, but I believe that there's been a phenomena where when magicians are in the circle, they experience a sense of panic without the spirit even showing up.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think, I mean, to be clear, it's not always just a sense of panic, but a very strong and sudden emotional response is not the least bit uncommon. I think the most common that we hear is a sense of dread that seems to have no stimulus. A sense of hopelessness and fear. I think that's, I mean, it's something I've experienced. It's something that I know that other people have certainly experienced. So yeah, that's an extremely common phenomena to occur in magical practice for sure.
Yeah. So what happens in these stories is that at some point, these folks will just lose it. And they will literally run down the side of this mountain. Now, again, as an old search and rescue volunteer, I can tell you that running on a mountainside is not a recommended behavior. But interestingly, all of these people made it off the mountain in one piece, despite, you know, there being cliffs and things that they could have fallen off of. They get to a certain level on the mountain and this feeling goes away and they're fine. As I said, you know, there's stories that, and I include them in the book, where, you know, people have actually shot at this thing. They perceived that they saw something in the fog and they shot at this thing at fairly close range with a revolver with no effect. So, you know, there's a very strong Sasquatch kind of tie-in there with the behavior of this creature in this sort of, you know, large bipedal shape materializing in the fog. But then you get this very spirit type of reaction from people who literally panic, who have that feeling of dread, as you said, that has seemingly, in this case, does have a source, whatever it is that's up there on the mountain with them. And then you have people just flee off this mountainside. Not only is the gray man a thing in the UK, but there's also a being in Wales, which appears to be something of a mountain spirit of some kind called the Monarch of the Mists, literally, that's said to create mist and throw mist around people.
Perfect band name. Let me tell you, that's it.
Yeah, Monarch of the Mist, yeah. Sort of a goth heavy metal band or something, you know. So, but this thing is said to be, again, you know, going back to the man-wolf thing, said to be very territorial. So talk about a genius loci. And will, you know, that creates these mists to keep mountaineers out of certain areas in the Welsh mountains. Now, that's all nice. It's a, you know, it's a nice legend and so forth. But there's also a witness encounter that I just loved, because this fellow's like a factory worker. He's out walking his dog in a Welsh village near the mountains, not in the mountains. He's out walking his dog. His dog, you know, very typical paranormal thing. His dog starts to freak out and comes and stands behind him, and it's scared of something. He looks up and he sees what he calls a gorilla in the bush. Now, gorillas are not indigenous to Wales, thank you. Sees what he called a gorilla in the bush that stands up and walks away, right? He called the local constabulary, and the local officer, I forget what they call it, it's like a crime prevention officer, made a statement that we get these, and he, quote, called this thing, quote, a Yeti. We get these Yeti reports all the time. He says, we take them very seriously and we'll be increasing patrol presence in that area. So it's like, okay, that makes me want to go talk to this guy and say, excuse me, but how many Yeti reports do you get every week? You know, that you can be so blasé about this? You know, I mean, how many people do you have coming to you and telling you that they're seeing gorillas in the local bush, you know, in Wales? It was one of those things that just, one of those stories that just made me smile, because it's like, I could just picture this guy standing, oh yeah, you know, we get these Yeti reports all the time and we take them seriously. And we go, it's like, you see that sometimes in the alien big cat stories, you know, where the guys, oh yeah, there's black cougars out there. We, you know, they're just really rare. Okay, if you know that, then we need pictures and stuff, because zoologists don't acknowledge but anyway,
yeah, I loved that story, by the way, about the witness encounter with the Monarch of the Mist, because to us, that's such a Bigfoot sighting. I mean,
but it's in a totally, you know, place where, you know, almost everybody will agree that couldn't happen.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
There's not enough shelter, cover, whatever, for a creature that size, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Now, Luke, obviously you are from the UK and you've been dealing with magic for a very long time. And I'm curious about, what, if fog has played any role, or if there's been any instances of fog that has come up within your life of magic.
What gave away that I'm from the UK, I wonder.
I couldn't tell at all.
No, of course. Instances of fog. You know, I think that the some of the time that you're in the early days of, and I'm talking, when I'm talking about magic, I'm talking about the grimoiric tradition, because I am a grimoire purist, and the early days when you're working the grimoires and you're getting less than spectacular results, it's fairly common. I had this. I had a couple of initial quite big successes, and then a slump for a little while where nothing really seemed to happen. And I've spoken to other magicians about this as well, and it was not uncommon to get some kind of you could call it a mist or a fog around the circle whilst conjuring, that never really seemed to do anything other than just appear and then dissipate once you finish the ritual off. It seemed to be almost a vehicle on which the spirits could arrive. And although that said, I'm not of the belief that incense smoke is a material by which the spirits will manifest with. I think that's fairly new. It was Mathers and Crowley that came up with that assertion. But, you know, the atmosphere around the magical operation has always been something that magicians have known to be incredibly important. And it's, you know, the reason that you burn incense, the reason that certain weather conditions or places are not conducive to a successful conjuration. And whilst there it doesn't seem to be, at least in the grimoires anyway, there doesn't seem to be a direct link with fog or mist, it does seem to be something that is a commonly reported phenomena in magical practice, for sure.
And it's interesting because, I mean, Luke, you've had, at least on some occasions, full physical manifestation when you've been doing these work. And we have this with, you know, Sasquatch and Wolf and Man-Wolf, like these full physical apparitions or physical manifestations of what could very possibly be an apparition. And so I find that a very, very interesting correlation. Travis, why don't we go into your conclusion? Because in the end of the book, I don't know if you want me to mention it or if you want to just talk about it from your own words.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, you make the point that it's very possible that a lot of the things that people are experiencing are as a result of what we'll call irresponsible magical operations. And I find this very, very interesting because this is kind of where I'm coming from, that the idea that a lot of this stuff is either in connection to the occult or is a direct symptom of occult practices.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a kind of a multi-pronged conclusion, because, you know, I talk about magic and magical workings kind of throughout the book. But you know, one of the things that I note is, you know, we are in the information age of occult lore. You know, if you walk into your local bookstore, chances are good that you can find a primer that will get you started working in, you know, in whatever tradition of magic it is you want to work in. Unfortunately, a lot of people approach these kinds of things with a less than serious intention, and without a really super disciplined approach. So you have the issue of, you know, a person who has a certain level of talent, perhaps getting their hands on the means to do some work, and then really sort of dropping it or dropping away from it or whatever, and not following through with their training. So you have a situation where you have people who are casting circles, doing ceremonial work, doing you know, whatever it is, conjurations of various sorts and kinds, working from these books. And a lot of these people are going to fail epically, you know, because they don't have the talent for it. They don't have the concentration for it. They don't have the discipline for it. But some of them aren't, you know. Some of them may have the natural talent to be able to open away. And then because they don't follow proper protocols, they don't close that way. And who knows what the hell comes through. In addition, I think that we can say that there are more people who are magically involved out there now than maybe there have been in quite a long time. And if you have places where people have been doing magic over and over and over again, you know, anything from druids working in a grove to Wiccans working in a circle to, again, ceremonial people doing their thing, grimoire people doing their thing, so on and so forth. Any place where we make an opening between the worlds, and, you know, even if we're closing that properly every time, you know, even the shamanic and medicine practices of native folks, eventually, in my view, creates places where the veil between the worlds is thinner. And that, in my mind, creates opportunities for beings from other planes to come through. Now, add that to the fact that there are actually beings in the other world that have that ability to move from their world to our world, and in the process pass through what some magicians call the etheric plane and gather substance to themselves and physically manifest, such that they leave tracks and so forth. And you have kind of a triple whammy going there, where magical practices and will actually create circumstances where these beings can get through into our world more easily. And because of these practices happening all over the world now, I think that there's more attraction for certain beings from the other world to come through. So that's kind of, you know, my conclusion in a nutshell. I talk about it pretty extensively in the conclusion, but, you know, and I know there are people that will argue with me, well, you know, if you do this ceremony properly, everything is closed down and that's all, you know, that's all said and done and good. But at the same time, if you read magical lore, you know, if you have a room that you've been using as a temple for, you know, the entire time that you've been staying in your home, most magical practitioners will tell you that you need to be sure that you go in and completely close down that temple and take it with you when you move out of your house, you know, because otherwise you're leaving a portal open.
Luke, I think you can speak to this point.
Yeah, I can actually. Yeah, and Travis is absolutely right in what he says there, and that you know, the purpose of a magical operation in the ceremonial tradition, at least, is to call, interrogate, or task a spirit, you know, to, if not physical appearance and something approximating that, enough for you to be able to get answers and be able to make an agreement for them to do something for you. Unfortunately, like moths to a flame, there are a number of other things that find the light of your ceremony to be quite appealing. And it's one of the reasons that when you read a lot of the older grimoires, the medieval and the Renaissance texts, you'll see that, you know, you give license to depart to the spirit that you've called, but you don't immediately step out of the circle. You wait for half an hour, 45 minutes, you pray. And if you, there's, if you still feel that tension in the atmosphere, then maybe you'll burn something that's less than pleasant smelling, because there are other things that are residual that are knocking around. And that's almost an accepted fact of magic nobody really talks about. Now, I personally have had experience where I've just hopped out of the circle thinking everything was hunky-dory, and have had some rather unpleasant goings on afterwards that were very real and very, very scary. But yeah, there's definitely something to that for sure. And I think areas of high concentration where these rituals have been performed, you know, it would not be a surprise to me if other things were lingering around there.
Absolutely. And one thing that I feel is that, with all that being said about these, you know, after so many rituals have been done in these certain areas and these beings have, the veil has been thinned and these beings come into our world and for some reason stay, it is my interest and my want to see if it's possible to use magical techniques to investigate these beings and, if possible, work with them and see if there's any kind of way that we can communicate with them and form some kind of a reciprocal relationship with them. So that way it's not so terrifying when people see a man wolf or a Sasquatch or even the Fae, because there's been a long history of people working with the Fae in a ritual setting. I mean, i.e. the Book of Oberon. But I think the same thing could be extended to apparitions, cryptids, and things like that. And Travis, I'm just curious about your thoughts on that.
Okay. So I have to preface this by saying that I need to be completely confidential, because I promised that I was going to be completely confidential. So this is going to be a very general story, but one that has some bearing on what we're talking about. But I can't really talk about who was involved, that sort of thing.
That's fine.
But I had a acquaintance who was interested in going out and doing Sasquatch research, and asked me pretty much that question. You know, is it possible to summon one of these things? And I said, well, yeah, I was hesitant to say, well, I don't know that you want to summon one of these things, but you could probably make it, you could probably arrange it such that it would be easier for this being, if it is a spirit, to pass through, you know, into our plane. And I gave this individual some recommendations for how to do that, which basically involved, you know, sort of an opening of the way kind of energetic work. So the person was out in the bush, out in deep forest, in an unnamed location, and did the kind of thing that I had recommended for them to do. Didn't pay much attention to it until they started getting the classic, you know, Sasquatch present stuff going on around them. Completely forgot that they had done this, actually, until they started getting, you know, the rock throwing, the movement in the bush, the, you know, the classic signs of, you know, the presence of a Sasquatch, right? And immediately went and shut this down. Because they scared the crap out of themselves. You know, reversed the process of what I had recommended for them. And at which point, the phenomena ceased entirely. So is it possible to use magical means to bring one of these creatures into your vicinity? Yeah, I think it's entirely possible. I think that Luke would probably be a better expert in how exactly you would key your working to a particular manifestation, whether, you know, if you were looking for Sasquatch versus man wolves or whatever. I think that would require some pretty intense research. Could it be done? Yeah, I think it probably could be done. And I think you know, if you had, a magician who was skilled in the use of these kinds of conjurations, you could make that happen. As to communicating and negotiating and that sort of thing, I don't know, I think it would be super interesting to find out if you could get a Sasquatch or a man wolf or a phantom black dog or whatever to manifest. Working in that style, you would be in a protected sacred enclosure. Even if it was a bit hostile, you probably could deal with it. So do I think it's possible? Oh yeah, I absolutely think it's possible. I think you'd need somebody like Luke though, to really, help you with the research to key your working to that particular, entity.
And I'm in luck, 'cause that is his office.
you have a bit of a previous history with magic, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, Travis?
You might say that. Yeah, I went through my ceremonial phase when I was younger. I call myself more of a pagan animist mystic these days. I don't do as much actual, you want to call it conjuration or spell work or, right, however you want to call that, as I did when I was younger. I tend to be a little more shamanic and, meditative now than I used to be, but yeah, I do have a past history.
do you mind me asking what the principal texts you were working from were when you were involved in ceremonial magic?
I did a lot of Golden Dawn stuff.
Right.
So, that's pretty much the kind of ceremonial things that I was doing. I always had an interest in grimoires, but never got to the point where I got the motivation going hard enough to really to dive into that.
Yeah, it's certainly demanding, that's for sure.
It's very demanding, and it's something that requires a lot of discipline and a lot of time and a lot of a lot of time that I didn't have at the time. So,
and money as well.
You have to have the ability to do the setup, and you have to have people in your life that are willing to leave you alone to let you do those things. And at that time, I just really didn't have that. So,
that's certainly one of the kind of more mundane practicalities of ceremony. Mm-hmm. It seems not answering your phone for a couple of days is a problem. You know, these days it really is.
Yes.
Did you when you were doing what you were doing, did you ever have the tangible contact with a spiritual being, being an angel, a demon, an aerial spirit, anything along those, something that...
define tangible.
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm asking in a nutshell is I'm just interested to hear, because obviously you've done huge amounts of research into the ghost black dog phenomenon, into the mm-hmm. myth and the paranormal. I'm wondering, I guess, what your most successful magical operations were, and was there anything that kind of intersected for you that has maybe even just cropped up in the back of your mind while you were doing this research?
I think that, this is where I get into oath sworn territory, and I have to tread carefully. I was a member of a group for a time that specialized in what you might call negative entities. You can call them whatever you want. Whatever you call them, they weren't nice. And those were some of my more successful workings. Dealing with these kinds of call them disharmonic entities, beings that do not resonate well with humankind.
That's a good way.
It's a phraseology that one of my first teachers taught me, and it's something that I come back to because it works for me. I have trouble thinking of spirits as being good and evil.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And even positive and negative kind of is odd, but there are some beings out there that just do not do well with humans, with the human energy field. And we perceive that in a very particular way. So some of my most successful workings had to do with that sort of thing and getting rid of that sort of thing for people who were being plagued by it. And again, I can't really go into specifics because, the group is such that they don't make their presence known. People find them. If you found them, then you really needed them. And that's kind of how that goes. As far as, your standard, ceremonial workings. Yeah. I've had, angelic experiences, very powerful angelic experiences, of the shock and awe, oh my God, falling on your face kind, where you encounter a being that you understand why the first words out of every angel's mouth in the Bible is fear not. Because it's not so much fear as it is just, the awareness that there are beings in the world that are or beings in other worlds, however you want to put it, that are extraordinarily powerful and capable of doing great things. Other very successful working that I did was way back when I was just a baby pagan, basically. And it wasn't like an official thing, but I had been asking for contact with Goddess, or the feminine divine, however you want to put that. And I had a very, very powerful dream, which has stayed to me to this day, in which I had an experience of, a feminine divinity radiating me with unconditional love. Which was an experience that I really needed at that point in my life. Mm-hmm. I haven't, summoned a spirit to visible manifestation or, anything like that. But, I've certainly had enough interaction with the spirit world to, believe in it, to believe in its power, and to understand that there are things that are capable of moving from one plane to the other and assuming physical form. There are very specific ways of preventing that. That's kind of where I come from.
Interesting. I shan't pry any more into that. But that's a very interesting subject. And it sounds like, you don't have to confirm nor deny this, but it sounds like what you were describing was something akin to exorcism in some way, shape, or form.
Exorcism is frequently, I guess it could be a terminology for some of the things that I got involved with. I prefer to think of it as relocation. because it's not like I'm going to go to your house and cast out demons and sprinkle holy water on you and all that sort of silly stuff. Yeah. That does work for some people. Sometimes you get into a situation where whatever it is strong enough to where you're going to go like, okay, so let's talk about this, right. And you get into negotiations instead of, an actual, exorcism, casting out of whatever it is. You could put it in that cast, I guess. Certainly the case that, the result, the desired result was the removal of that entity from that particular area or that particular person.
Yeah.
And it's not as easy as they make it look on paranormal TV.
Well, I have no doubt of that. Yeah.
Well, Travis, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. And Mysteries in the Mist is available now. You can get it on Amazon. I highly recommend it. I also highly recommend, you know, when you're finished it, please rate it. But also there's Black Dogs, Walkers of the Liminal Way, and you're also working on a new book, correct?
Correct. I moved to Canada a couple of years ago. I live in Kitchener, Ontario now. My spouse is a native Canadian and came back here to work at the university in Waterloo. Of course, being the paranormalist and the animist and so forth that I am, I thought, oh, well, I wonder what sorts of interesting stories there are here in Canada. Down the rabbit hole I went again. So it's the tentative title of the book is Canadian Monsters and Mysteries. I'm not sure I'm going to keep that. But, again, we're going to cover the wide range from I don't talk about Sasquatch in this one because everybody talks about Sasquatch.
Yeah, there's plenty more to Canadian weirdness than Sasquatch.
Oh, so, yeah. We have lake monsters. Oh, my God. We got every lake in Canada seems to have a monster in it.
Luke lives in Canada as well. And so imagine that maybe some of the things that you encounter may be a result of some of his workings.
Where are you in Canada, Luke?
I'm in British Columbia. So
Okay.
Yeah, I'm in a good spot for solitude and weirdness, which is
for releasing Sasquatches into the wild, right?
Amen, brother. That's it. Yeah.
But like I said, I'm in Kitchener, Ontario. But what I discovered was that, you know, of course, Canada has a vast collection of, you could do whole books on hauntings in Canada, probably hauntings here in Ontario. You could do whole books on, of course, the Sasquatch stuff. There's tons of UFO lore. There's tons of lake monster stuff. There's tons of just really weird humanoid reports, cryptids of various kinds. Luke, if you haven't read it, find a copy of John Warm's Strange Creatures Seldom Seen.
Okay.
It's I think it's available in PDF or you may be able to get it as an ebook. But it's directly available, not like Amazon or anything like that. He sells it on off of a website, but spent a considerable amount of time amongst First Nations people in Manitoba. And he's got some cryptid stories that will just absolutely knock you on your rear end because, you know, I've been involved in this stuff, you know, since my 20s, and I'm 61 now. There were things in that book I had never heard of before. So if you're interested in Canadian cryptid lore, that's definitely one for your collection.
Well, consider my interest peaked. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll also be picking up a bag.
Yeah, so I'll be doing should be coming out in summer sometime. It's the manuscripts due at the 1st of July, and they usually turn things beyond the fray. Usually turns things around pretty quickly.
Awesome! I'm really excited about that, and I would love to have you on the show again to talk about it.
Great, I'd love to do it.
Well, Travis, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope you have a great day.
Oh, you too. Thanks very much to you and Luke. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
As is ours.
Real pleasure.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a good night.
Okay. You too.
All right. Bye. That was our interview with W.T. Watson, author of Mysteries in the Mist. We will be having him back on to talk about his future books and maybe some of his past books. With that, everybody, have a great night, and we'll see you again on The Strange Dominions.